This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Some years, the ocean soaks up almost 40% of all the carbon humans dump into the atmosphere. It is a free carbon capture and sequestration system, and it saved us from heating up even faster. Scientists just discovered why that ocean carbon system has gone up and down in recent decades. The ocean responds much more quickly to changes in the atmosphere than anybody thought. And that turns out to be good news, but it's also worrying news in a way. Galen McKinley is professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in New York. She is lead author of this groundbreaking study titled External Forcing Explains Recent Decadal Variability of the Ocean Carbon Sink. Galen McKinley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Like a lot of great science, your research broke a lot of previous ideas that I had in my mind about how the ocean works. Why did you set out to do this study, and did you expect these surprising results that you got?
So we've been working for many years trying to understand what drives the ocean carbon sink and its variability. But only in the recent few years have we had new ways of looking at our data that have revealed these clear patterns of an ocean carbon sink that was quite strong in the early 1990s, that didn't grow much over the rest of the 1990s, and then grew strongly after the 1990s. These are using sparse data sets and with techniques such as machine learning that have become all the rage across science and industry in recent years. And they've really allowed us to uncover these patterns for the first time. And we noted that when we have multiple of these database estimates from independent authors and some of our simulations of the ocean, if we look at those simulations together and those database products together, we noted that they were both showing us actually the same signal of an ocean carbon sink that was strong in the early 1990s, not growing very much over the rest of the decade, and then growing quickly after. And when you see a clear signal from two quite independent approaches, one data, one fully simulation, you know, why? Why is this happening becomes the question. So we set out to explain that. And what we learned is that much of the variability in the ocean sink has really been driven not by the ocean circulation varying on its own, or El Nino events, for example, but is in fact responding to two external forcings, the first being just the growth rate of atmospheric CO2, so how fast we are putting carbon in the atmosphere. That growth rate is largely driven by emissions from humans, but also driven by the uptake of carbon by land plants. To first order, and that is really then a key driver of the sink variability. But then we found that in the 1990s, the pattern didn't match. And with our modeling, we found that if we added the effects on the global surface temperature of the large volcanoes that occurred, the last big one being 1990-91, Mount Pinatubo, that then led us to recover the year-to-year pattern of the carbon sink, very much like in these global scale database estimates and large, you know, full three-dimensional simulations. Essentially, we saw the signal in these complex models and database products, realized that that signal was there, and then used very simple theoretical approach to explain it and try to understand why it was happening. And that, I think, the fact that we could pull all those together was one of the exciting things for me about this particular paper.
But I guess I thought that the massive ocean would be the force that would regulate the atmosphere, but nope. When it comes to this, it's really the atmosphere that regulates how this carbon dioxide is going into the ocean.
Yes, and I think that is really a function of the fact that we are just putting so much carbon in the atmosphere year after year. We're adding every year more and more carbon, and we're essentially driving it into the ocean, and the ocean is acting as a sponge that, as you know, is ever more taking up this carbon. But we're in this regime of really exponential growth in the atmospheric CO2 concentration. And under those situations, that is what drives the sink. It's essentially just this pressure from the atmosphere ever pushing more carbon in. But one of the outgrowths of the study is it indicates that when we stop having that exponential growth in the atmospheric CO2, in other words, when we start to mitigate our emissions and start to bring down that growth rate, which of course we need to do from a climate change perspective, but when we do that, the ocean will stop taking as much up quite immediately. The ocean will stop being as strong a sink. Because there's all this carbon stuffed into the surface ocean that is going to say, well, now it's time to equilibrate with an atmosphere that isn't growing so quickly. And so the ocean sink will slow down quite rapidly when we stop adding carbon, ever more carbon to the atmosphere. So that, I think, is an important outgrowth of the work.
Well, that's what I'm going to put under worrying news, because I know human nature, we want immediate gratification. And if we're going to have to sacrifice perhaps some convenience or wealth to reduce carbon emissions, but the ocean sort of scratches out the benefits we would have seen in the short run, you see the danger here.
I do. And I think that's, you know, I think one of the reasons we wanted to get this work out and talk to as many people about it as we can is we want everyone to be aware that the physics of the system are such that the ocean takes about 1,000 years to mix from top to bottom. And so the carbon that we put in the atmosphere, that 40% that has accumulated in the ocean since pre-industrial times of all of our fossil emissions, that is mostly stored in the surface ocean. And those waters are in contact with the atmosphere. So there's going to be a period of equilibration in which we're cutting our emissions to try to bring down the atmospheric growth rate. But the ocean is now experiencing a lesser growth rate and is going to be a less efficient sink. And so we have to account for that in our estimates of allowable emissions. And it is, this effect is accounted for to some degree in our model-based estimates of allowable emissions. I think we have to make sure it is that we really can quantify that quite accurately to the best of our ability, that we understand how the ocean circulation, how the carbon system works, so we can do a really good job of making those estimates. But just from a public relations standpoint, I think the people of the world need to understand that some of these natural sinks in the ocean and probably also on the land that are helping us by sucking up our excess carbon, come off the accelerator in terms of adding carbon year after year, those sinks are going to be less efficient. And that's just the reality of the Earth system that we live in.
And as I was trying to learn climate science during the 1990s, the holy grail, the predominant theory was that the ocean would accept less and less carbon dioxide over the coming decades. I must have read 100 news articles that said that as well. So that's out?
So, right. So I think some of the big questions with respect to the ocean sink are also, for example, how much this overturning circulation, say the North Atlantic, Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC as it's called, if that large-scale circulation in which waters that get quite cold and dense in the high North Atlantic sink to the deep ocean and begin this 1,000-year circuit, taking them through the Atlantic and the Southern Ocean and into the Pacific, if that circulation was to significantly slow down, say, because of a lot of fresh water ending up in the North Atlantic and making those waters less dense and less able to sink, if that circulation slows down, then that slows the pathway by which these high carbon waters make it into the deep ocean. And that would slow down the ocean carbon sink for sure. But on the other hand, there is the natural chemistry of carbon in water is such that carbon is quite soluble in water, and a lot of carbon can be taken into the waters, particularly if you add more and more carbon to the atmosphere, which is the regime that we're in right now, where we're just stuffing it in so quickly. There is some chemistry that pushes back on that, that makes that process less efficient over time. But if we keep putting carbon in the atmosphere year upon year, we will keep driving it into the ocean. We will acidify the ocean, which has a whole host of problems and concerns quite severe. But the ocean will keep modulating our global warming effect. But the more we stuff in there, then, of course, by the time we do eventually start to mitigate, if it's in the next 10 years or in the next 50 years, there will be more carbon to equilibrate with the atmosphere. And so our problem gets worse in terms of that equilibration phase, the more we delay in cutting those emissions, right? So that equilibration phase with the surface ocean, when we start to mitigate, is inevitable. But the more carbon we stuff in there, the more water we stuff into that sponge or something, the more it's going to want to come back at us when we start to mitigate. And so the longer that equilibration phase will be. So our trajectory matters. And also, the more we put into the surface ocean, the more ocean acidification will occur. And that's a real problem for ocean ecosystems. So it all points to the need to start mitigating as soon as possible. But the reality is these are long timescale effects. And like you said, we can't expect an immediate gratification for our cuts. We're going to have to commit to cuts and keep doing them year upon year, and it will have an effect. But, for every petagram of emissions we cut, we're not going to see a petagram of cut in the atmosphere because of these feedbacks with the ocean sink and the land sink probably also.
So is it possible if we waited, say, till 2050 to really slash emissions and then we go to some sort of net zero economy, we're not putting out emissions, the ocean itself could become the major carbon polluter for a century or two while it emits what it's got in there?
Well, if we really went to zero emissions, let's say at 2050, which is pretty unlikely, then I guess maybe the ocean could become the dominant source. I'd have to look at those numbers a bit to be sure. That's not a kind of scenario we usually think of because zero emissions doesn't seem very likely. So the ocean is right now a major player in the carbon budget. I mean, right now in each year now of about 10 petagrams of fossil fuel emissions from humans, about 25% per year goes into the ocean. So it's a major term in the global carbon budget. And then the 40% that you mentioned in the intro is actually if we sum up all the emissions of fossil fuels over all of time, about 40% have gone into the ocean to date. So it's a major player. Exactly how that carbon budget will look when we start to mitigate really does depend on our trajectory of emission cuts and how high we've gotten in terms of the atmospheric concentration and how much carbon we've stuffed into the ocean by that time.
So it would matter a lot if we're, say, at 500 parts per million or 600 parts per million when we start to make the cuts. We're really pressing stuff into the ocean all that time.
Yes, that's right. And so you would, if we, these are calculations we haven't really done in detail yet, but will be worth doing. There's been some work on it, I guess. It's not my primary focus at this point, but right, to really understand, how many years of equilibration would happen dependent upon whether you start cutting emissions at 450 parts per million versus 500 versus 600 versus 700. But it's clear that because as you have more in the atmosphere, you're going to have more in the surface ocean, that equilibration phase is going to be extended the more we have in the atmosphere, like the higher we go before we start to come down. And every analysis, whether it be economic or of potential tipping points in the climate system or of biological impacts or of ice sheets, all of them indicate that the sooner we mitigate, the less likely we get ourselves into a place that we don't want to be. So this is just one of many studies pointing us to that need.
As you point out in your study, at least 96% of the oceans don't have any monitoring equipment. How sure are we that carbon in the marine environment gets evenly distributed, like carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is presumed to do?
Well, it's not exactly evenly distributed, but it is distributed per the ocean circulation. So we both have observations, very, very sparse of the surface ocean that happen every year. A few percent of the global ocean is observed. But then we also do studies. People go out on ships, research ships, and do sort of like a curtain of observations of the whole surface to depth of the ocean. For example, from Iceland all the way down to the Falkland Islands, taking 2 months to stop every 50 kilometers and take water samples all the way from the surface to the depth of the ocean. And with those kinds of observations where you actually get a water sample, you can measure many, many different chemical constituents, including carbon, oxygen, nutrients, chlorofluorocarbons. With those kinds of observations, we can really back out the distribution of carbon across the global ocean. And that is how we really know where the carbon that's gone into the ocean is being stored. and we can say show that it's mostly stored in the surface ocean, and only maybe 10% or so is in what we consider the deep ocean. Of all of our emissions to date, 10% of the deep ocean.
Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Galen McKinley from Columbia University and Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. We're talking about why the sea captures our carbon pollution, sometimes less, sometimes more. So, Galen, you found two major drivers, and we've been talking about the carbon dioxide, but there's also the whole question of volcanoes. Could you talk to us about what you found with Mount Pinatubo?
Yes, right. So these large volcanoes that have gone off in the Earth system, for example, El Chichon in 1982 and Mount Pinatubo in 1991, they can have major effects on the global climate because they spew aerosols not only into the troposphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, but all the way into the stratosphere. And those aerosols reflect solar radiation quite efficiently, and they can remain in the stratosphere for many months, if not years, and cool the planet. So the observations of temperature of the global oceans right after the Mount Pinatubo, and a year or two after Mount Pinatubo, was that there was a significant cooling of the global ocean, about 0.2 degrees or 0.2 of a degree, that really persisted for at least a couple of years beyond the that eruption. And because carbon is more soluble in cold water, this meant that the ocean in 91, 92, after that eruption in the middle of 91, took up about half a petagram more than it would have otherwise, just because of this cooling effect. But this cooling effect was quite well distributed across the globe. It happened essentially everywhere. And so you have 70% of the Earth covered in ocean. Everything gets cooler, and so you suck up more carbon in that year. And that effect hadn't been recognized until our study. And also quite interestingly is we haven't had a large volcanic eruption like Pinatubo since 1991. We can't predict them. But now if we did see another big eruption occurring, we would be able to predict that the ocean carbon sink would be substantially increased in the years following such an eruption.
So the eruption might temporarily help us hide some of our emissions.
Yeah, that's right. And some of the simulations that we do have, computer model simulations, kind of like weather models of the ocean that include the carbon chemistry, illustrate that the signal of uptake of excess carbon as well as excess oxygen actually penetrated at least down to 500 or 600 meters in the ocean. And since that's pretty deep, those signals can persist at depth for a decade or so and sort of be this sort of cold anomaly in the thermocline of the ocean. So that's something that we're now starting some new simulations with the climate models to better understand how those signals of high carbon, cold, and high oxygen waters all move throughout the global oceans.
And then we had one of the few cases where a major industrial country cut its emissions, which is when the Soviet Union fell around 1989, 1990. And right now we have the economy of many countries almost closed down due to the pandemic. How will the ocean respond to those fairly rapid human reductions?
Yeah, that's a very good question and something we've been thinking about a lot. So we are cutting our fossil fuel emissions. A recent study from a consortium of people known as the Global Carbon Project, a recent study suggested that our CO2 emissions for this year will be probably cut between 4 and 7% on an annual basis. And that is because of cuts in transportation, cuts in air travel, some cuts in industry, for example. And a lot of, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty that, and a lot of that uncertainty is about how we come back, how rapidly the economy comes back, of course, which is uncertain, of course. So then the question becomes, if we cut the emissions of CO2 by 4 to 7% of what it would have been without COVID-19, what would happen to the ocean sink? Well, if we just, in a very simple calculation, make an estimate of that, we would we would estimate that the ocean sink would decline by about, if it was a 5% cut in the atmosphere, it would be about 1% cut of the ocean sink. So, yes, the ocean sink, I think, probably will decline in the global mean by a little bit compared to what it would have been without COVID-19. However, the reality is our observational system is not really up to the task of observing such a relatively small change. And we have the reality of the Earth out there is that there's a lot of natural variability that complicates our ability to detect such a relatively small change. So there's El Nino variability, there's the PDO variability that affects, the Pacific Northwest quite a bit. There's all sorts of other modes of variability that would make it really hard to detect that magnitude of a reduction in the ocean sink. So maybe if we had perfect observations and could really understand all the patterns of variability, maybe we'd be able to see it, but I just don't think we will, even though I think that there probably will be some effect. That said, I think that the cuts happening with COVID-19 are a good chance for Earth scientists to see what we can do, see how much we can see in our observations, ask the question, because it's kind of maybe a dry run for what we'd start to see when we do start to mitigate more seriously than we have to date, and the atmospheric growth rate starts not to get larger every year, but get smaller every year, which is the first step towards really solving the climate change problem.
How sensitive is the ocean, Galen? I mean, how fast can the ocean react to these changes in the atmospheric carbon?
Well, so that's one of the things that we found in our study. We found that really it's quite immediate, that the flux of carbon between the atmosphere and the ocean is determined by the gradient or the difference between the CO2 in the atmosphere and the CO2 in the surface ocean. That's what sets the magnitude of the flux. And so because the atmosphere is quite well mixed and is changing largely homogeneously at the global scale, I think the effect is quite immediate. That's what we found. And we show that not only with rather simple theoretical model, but also with climate models, ocean simulations, and it's also quite consistent with the data. So I think that the fact that the ocean can respond that quickly, it makes sense, but I think we're the first people to really make it clear that that's what's happening in terms of the year-to-year variability.
If I read your paper correctly, it seems our estimates of total greenhouse gas emissions could be off by maybe up to 10%. Why does this conundrum of the ocean carbon capture make even that basic number uncertain?
Yes, right. So the point there is that every year, this group called the Global Carbon Project does an amazing job of pulling together the current best estimates of the ocean sink, the fossil fuel emissions, the land sink, and land use change emissions. And they do that 2019, they do it for 2018. So as quickly as possible, they pull all that data together and come up with a real estimate. And ideally, we would be able to say, here is an independent estimate of our emissions, an independent estimate of the ocean sink, an independent estimate of the land sink. And if we add all those up, we can directly replicate the atmospheric, what we've observed in the atmosphere, sort of as a check on our ability to balance that budget. And we can do quite a good job, but it's still about 10% uncertainty in our ability to close that budget. There's still some uncertainty. And so, I think we understand to first order what the Earth system is doing, but again, this challenge comes to what happens when we cut emissions and people want to say, well, the countries of the world cut their emissions, made an effort, did it have an effect in the atmosphere? Did the atmospheric growth rate go down? Or, alternatively, why didn't the atmospheric growth rate go down this year? Carbon cycle scientists like myself are part of the team that needs to be able to say, yes, you cut your emissions. However, the land sink, there was a little bit less strong of a land sink this year, say, because there was an El Nino that was partially balanced by this effect. And then, we need to be able to explain to the people of the world what's going on with the atmospheric growth rate in the context of emissions. And because the Paris Agreement has a 5-year stock take or a 5-year period on which the people of the world are supposed to come back and say, okay, I cut this much in the last 5 years. This is my commitment in the next year. the time frame for us as carbon cycle scientists to really be able to make that diagnosis is about 5 years. And the problem is that 10% uncertainty is too much. It's too large, and we can't do it within 10 years. We can't really make an attribution of cuts in the growth rate to cuts in emissions until we reduce that uncertainty in the land and ocean sinks. We need to know them better so we can really be able to say, yes, the reason the atmospheric growth rate did this in these last 5 years is because you cut your emissions, the land sink did this, the ocean sink did this, and we can balance that and we can verify it, you know, with high certainty. So that was the point there, is that we need to be able to do a better job of really quantifying each of these terms so that we can diagnose and understand and explain to policymakers where the carbon has come from and where it's gone to.
Okay, bottom line, as we wrap up here, if you were advising a world leader or the IPCC or my listeners, what would your new science suggest about what humans should do and what we should expect from the ocean carbon system?
Well, what should we do? I think we should make a serious effort to cut our emissions and start those efforts today and plan to sustain them for a long period of time. We need to think about the effects of those cuts on a very long-term integrated effect, that we might make cuts this year and we might not see really the benefits in some sense of those cuts for a decade or longer. We know that even in just terms of climate warming, that even if we were to really cut our emissions quite strongly right now, warming would continue for several decades. So we really have to take the long view. We really have to think about our children and our grandchildren. And we have to listen to science, and we have to put some more money into, for example, observing the ocean and really being able to quantify these things so we can make better decisions as the Earth systems evolve in response to our mitigation efforts and in response to the climate change that's already occurring. But I think that long view is, you know, we got to understand the Earth, and we got to take that long view of, you know, we're talking about planet Earth, space, you know, our great lifeboat Earth here, and it doesn't operate entirely on human timescales, and we have to be respectful of that.
Amen. We have been speaking with Dr. Galen McKinley from Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. She led the new paper published in the AGU Advances on June 3rd. You can find links to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Galen, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.